are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 432. If it's important to you, you will find a way. If it's not, you will find an excuse. Anonymous.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari.
Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success.
The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T chart. Well, guys, I'm super excited about today's episode. We are talking to legendary director Raja Gosnell. And you might not know the name right away, but you will definitely know the movies he's worked on, not only as a director, but early in his career as an editor. As an editor, he worked on films like Mrs. Doubtfire, Home Alone, Home Alone 2, and Pretty Woman, just to name a few. And after working with some of the most amazing directors and filmmakers of their day, like Arthur Hiller, Gary Marshall, John Hughes, and Chris Columbus, he decided to leave the editor's chair and dive into directing. And he's built a pretty solid directing career for himself, I have to say. He directed the cult hit Never Been Kissed with Drew Barrymore, the blockbuster Big Mama's House, and then his career really kicked into high gear with Scooby-Doo, Scooby-Doo 2, Beverly Hills Chihuahua, You, Mine, and Ours, and the international blockbusters, The Smurfs and The Smurfs 2. Raja is a really, really fascinating guy. I loved, love our conversation. I wanted to discuss how you direct, you know, animated characters within a live action scene. And he is by far one of the most go-to directors in Hollywood for that. And I really wanted to get into that, as well as his editing past, how his editing career helped his directing career. And we also discussed his new movie, Gun and a Hotel Bible. We'll get deep into that as well. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Raja Gosnell. I'd like to welcome to the show Raja Gosnell. How are you doing, Raja?
I'm great. Good to be here, Alex.
Oh, thank you so much for coming on the show, man. I am a fan of your work, not only as a director, sir, but also as an editor when you first started out. But we'll get into that in a minute. But I really do appreciate you you coming on and talking shop with the tribe today, man.
I love it, man. Can't wait.
All right. So how did you get into this ridiculous business?
I was very lucky. I started as a driver at Robert Altman's Lionsgate Films way back. And they were shooting a movie called A Wedding. And my job was to drive to the airport at 3 a.m. to pick up the film that was coming in and take it to the lab. And I would spend the rest of my days in the cutting room, just doing, you know, whatever, helping out the guys. And, you know, they taught me how to use the coating machine. Like, I think you never cut on film, but like
I cut on film once, but this is
the so you have to put these little numbers on, so the picture and
the bins,
all this stuff.
Yeah.
So, and I was just fascinated watching the guys work and with that whole process, and just sort of, you know, hung around as much as I could, hung around in my extra time, and they'd give me stuff just to get rid of me to do, and I did it well, and so they hired me as an assistant editor. Back in the day, with the union, it had to be like, you had to be 8 years before you could be an editor. There's all these different stages, kind of. But anyways, they hired me, and throughout my course at the with Altman, I worked from, you know, the driver to as first assistant editor on the movie Popeye. So it was a really good run for me. It's great.
Wow.
You know, it's like super indie there. Like something would come off the chem machine and Raj, go out and mix it. And I'd go out in the theater and thread up the machines, and I had like a little mixing board. And so it was very, very hands on and just a wonderful place to learn, and great people. You know, Tony Lombardo and Dennis Hill were the editors, and Bob was sort of in and out, larger than life. And
I have to stop you. How was it working with Robert Altman?
It was amazing and wonderful, and it's everything you think. It was crazy. He was just a larger than life figure, and you know, we nicknamed him the Bear because he just kind of rolled in, and you know, we'd be working, he'd roll in like 10 o'clock at night and have a scotch in one hand and a joint in the other, and you know, just sort of, okay, we're going to start working. And then, you know, you get these crazy notes, like, let's take the beginning of the scene and put it at the end and put it, you know. But you knew what he was talking about. You know what I mean? It wasn't, that's when I learned it wasn't like specifically what someone's asking for. It's the idea of what someone's asking for. And it's the note behind the note. And it was just a fantastic learning experience. And he was a great, great guy, and treated his people really well. And, yeah, I miss him.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, Bob is Bob. I mean, he's the player, and we can go on and on and on. But he was amazing. He was absolutely amazing. And Popeye. So you actually you worked with Robin, you know, in a sense, with Robin Williams at the beginning of his filmmaking career, and then later on you worked on Miss Doubtfire as an editor as well. So you're working as an assistant editor and working your way up, and again, this is a different time, and if everyone listening, like it was a whole different time. There was very much more of a apprentice like system in place where you would like you said, do 8 years.
Yeah, the union requires a certain amount of years before you could advance to the next thing. It's like other unions where they're trying to protect the people that are there, and I think right. They've abolished all that.
Yeah, because now anybody with a Final Cut system or resolves, I'm an editor now. Like it just and it, you know, which is great and bad at the exact same time. But so then you went from your first feature that you edited was Lonely Guy, if I'm not mistaken, right? Or was it one of the first?
I was co-editor on that. Okay. We edited it with Bill Reynolds, who was an amazing Oscar-winning editor. I was his first assistant, and I think I got editing credit on that. I think the first. You know, I sort of went off to the B movie world to do things. So there's something like Soldier's Revenge, and there was a one called Beverly Hills Air Force or whatever. And so some comedies like that and
80s, all the 80s.
Yeah, exactly. Movies you've never heard of or probably will never see. But it was good learning grounds, man. It was, you know, you were sort of on your own and working with very little in terms of like actual material, you had to sort of create scenes and stuff. So it was good learning that ground. And I sort of came back into the studio world again with Bill Reynolds working on a movie called Making Love. Arthur Hiller directed that. And and we did a few movies with Arthur through that run. Lonely Guy was one of them, and Author was one of them with Al Pacino, and so it was a very good run, and I learned a whole different set of skill sets from Bill Reynolds, and that was just sort of the politics of the editing room and how to manage the personalities, and so yeah, it was a fantastic playground that I grew up in, and couldn't have asked for a better time.
Yeah, I mean, and Arthur Hiller, for people who don't know who he is, I mean, he's a legendary comedy director. I mean, he kind of broke Richard Pryor in. Yeah. With Silver Streak and all of these other, you start looking at his filmography, you're just like, Jesus, man, he was a legend. He really, really was a legend. And he did the biggest movie in 1970, which was Love Story.
Yeah.
Like that was like the Titanic of his day.
I know. And you look back at that movie and it's so simple and so simply done. And it hit a chord. It hit the zeitgeist, and mm-hmm. the performances were great. And lightning in the bottle, man. That's the film business. Sometimes you just don't know what's going to be the thing. And I think that's one thing that attract people to the business in general is like, no 2 days are the same. And you can make a great movie and fail miserably, and you can make a bad movie and succeed. And you know, it's kind of like going to Vegas, I guess.
It's an insane business. And you're right, there is that kind of like chance. I think it's that thing that draws people in. It's like it's the lottery ticket. It's like at any moment, I could just write that script, get that part, direct that project, you know, or do something that will blow me up. But you and I both know the chances of that happening is a lottery ticket. Like it happens once in a while. It's just the journeyman that kind of just keep hustling, keep working, coming in every day, in and out, that kind of build a career like yourself. Like you didn't like break out when you were 20. you paid your dues.
Dang, I don't think I was ready at 20.
I know, right? It's like, no, I was definitely not ready in any of my 20s, honestly. My entire 20s, I wasn't ready. Now, how did you connect with Chris Columbus?
So I had worked on a miniseries called America, spelled with a K. And it was, the premise of it was the Russians, / Russian bloc had taken over the United States. And it was, they didn't spend any time on like how that actually happened. There was, it was actually sort of omniscient in a way, because the story thing was they somehow got a hold of the communication systems and just convinced everybody that this was the new thing, which is happening today.
I was about to say, it's
like, well, shit, really, that is kind of could go down, you know, because it seemed preposterous at the time, you know, the setup at least was. But the show itself was like, how would an ordinary American who grew up under an American system react to living in a Soviet type system? And that was the premise of it. But that was a long way around to saying that the post supervisor, whose name was Dave McCann, on that liked me, and I was, generally doing good work for that one. And so he moved to Disney to be the post supervisor there. And this movie came in. This young director, Chris Columbus, had directed it. And they had just had a massive film on one sequence, and the regular editing crew just sort of didn't have time to jump on it. And sort of what I'd done on America was all the mass, the big scenes. So he's like, I know a guy. So I came in and I cut basically the Blues Bar sequence in Adventures in Babysitting.
Nice.
Which was sort of, it's a fun scene. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of a tent pole within that movie. And when Chris got his next gig, he called me up and said, hey, man, I want you to do the movie. So I was like, yes, thank you, sir. And we went off and did a little movie called Heartbreak Hotel, which
I remember.
Was fun to make. It was a disaster, at the box office and critically as well, I think. And I think Chris was thinking, oh, well, there,
that's it. I'm done.
Ohio. Yeah, exactly. but then he got a little movie called Home Alone with John Hughes and went off to do that and asked me to do that. And so that was that was the e-ticket ride for both of us, I think.
I remember when Heartbreak Hotel. Yeah, I remember, because I still remember the video, the VHS box, because I was working at a video store, and I built a standee I built a standee for it for our video store. I remember it very carefully. I remember watching it. I enjoyed it when I watched it. But I remember it not being a huge hit. And I used to recommend
it. Why is there only one of these?
It wasn't like a whole wall of them. There was probably like two or three, I think, we got at that point, because they were still – see, now I'm dating myself. But it was, I think, like still like $99 or $79 to buy a VHS, because it wasn't sell through at that point.
Right.
So, and then you worked on that little film called Home Alone, which I mean, nobody knew, right? Nobody knew that it was going to turn into.
Nobody knew. And we knew we were making a charming little, Christmas movie with a great child actor and funny guys, with Joe and Danny. And like, look, the previews, it previewed through the roof in terms of the sneaks. Like, people are falling out of their seats laughing.
I mean, it's funny.
We've done that before. Like, the preview, great, you know, but it didn't necessarily, no one went to see it. But the studio got excited about it. And John Hughes, at the height of his power during these days, had a lot of, he could pretty much, he was the 800 pound gorilla, I guess. He got what he wanted. And like the final bit of fairy dust that came in was they asked Chris who he wants to compose, and he said, "I like John Williams." And they're like, "Okay, let's get John Williams." And fortunately, John had done he did the Boston Pops for a long time, and they always finished their Christmas things with these big Christmas numbers and with a big choir and everything. And we had temped the movie Home Alone with Nutcracker Suite and with, you know, sort of all these sort of things that Boston Pops already played. And John was like, "I want to do a Christmas movie." And so it was just perfect happenstance that the most amazing composer ever decided to take our little movie. And you know, it went from a 9.5 to an 11, just his little magic touch across everything just elevated the movie. And, you know, we got a good release date. I think we released against a Rocky or a Rambo, some Stallone movie.
Mm-hmm.
And like, we're just number one.
Oh, Kindergarten Cop. I remember Kindergarten Cop was, you guys were fighting Kindergarten Cop, and everyone was like, how is this little kid beating Arnold Schwarzenegger at the peak of his power?
I know. It was, I think it was just repeat viewing. It's like someone would view it and they'd say, "You got to see this."
It grew the second week. I remember it grew in box office the second week. So like, if it made 20 million, it made like 30 million the next week or something
like
that.
I think it was number one, like through April. I don't know what that says about the other movies or what, but it was just, it was lightning in a bottle completely.
But you were involved with a lot of lightning in a bottle, because you got, you know, Home Alone, and then you got to work with Gary Marshall with Pretty Woman, which also, you know, I kind of know some of the story behind that, the $3,000 and the original ending of that movie. And I think one of the producers was a teacher at my school, my film school. So I kind of heard a lot of the inside stuff of what happened before it was public knowledge. And you know, Gary kind of, he's like a Chris Columbus. He kind of come in and just fairy dust on,
exactly.
and it just turned into this insane hit.
And the chemistry between Richard and Julia was just like, you know, Gary was really good at making that happen, but there was also an extra thing that no one could have predicted that just happens between those two.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's basically a Cinderella story with a prostitute. It's like, let's do it. Bookending it with a guy, you know, walking through the streets talking about, you know, living your dreams and through, like, let's just own that it's a fairy tale. You know what I mean?
So who was that? Gary? That was a Gary idea?
That was Gary.
That was so, like, you guys, like, you weren't hiding that this was just a fairy tale. Like, this obviously will never happen in real life. Like, this is.
Well, we didn't want to say that. Saying like, well, yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, he climbs the staircase at the end, and mm-hmm. you know, there's a line about a prince, and what did she do when he saved her? He says she saved him right back. You know, it's just a great movie that it holds up beautifully, and I give it down to Gary and the chemistry between those two actors.
Yeah, and then again with Miss Doubtfire. Mrs. Doubtfire, another, I mean, how, okay, I have to ask you, because I've never spoken, I've spoken to a lot of people who've worked with Robin, written with Robin, but I've never heard anyone that's edited Robin Williams. How do you edit Robin Williams? Because I'm assuming you don't have just one take. You probably have 30 amazing takes per shot that you need. So how does that work?
Actually, I was lucky enough to edit Robin twice.
Right.
I did most of the broadcast sequences in Good Morning Vietnam.
Oh,
so, wow. Yeah, that was great. That was another one of my little lucky breaks that we need a big scene guy. Here's a scene. Here's a movie that has a bunch
That's
of,
your niche. That was your box. Niche.
Like, send in Raja. So the second time, I mean, the shooting style was just like, let's get at least one or two scripted just so we have that in the bottle. And then Robin go. And I would literally have 30 takes. If you want to get a little technically into the weeds, it was the first movie I'd done electronically, and I was on a Lightworks system.
Lightworks.
Yeah. And I loved the system. It was great. But like, you know, remember those big towers that every computer.
Oh, yeah. So, and that was like 50 megs.
I don't know.
It was like, megs, yeah, but you would have like a refrigerator and it was like 100 megs.
Yeah, exactly. So the Lightworks could manage three of those things at a time. And by the time we finished shooting and we shot the equivalent of a million feet of film, I had like 20 of those things spread out. So to run the movie, I'd have to go to the specialist and say, plug in number 5 and number 3 and number 12 over there so I could run the scene, you know, because but yeah, just cutting that look, I mean, it was just an embarrassment of riches. And so I actually don't think I could have done it on film just to have access to all that stuff. And the hardest thing was a lot of times, like, the best setup for a joke would be over here in take 7, but then like the best payoff and reaction would be over here in take 10 or 11. But he said this one in present tense and he'd deliver this one in past tense, and because he's just going, you know? And so I'd have to go through like, you know, hours of film to find like an ED to put the end of that word. So that's past tense. So just like little things that you'd never think of, is sort of what went into sort of building all that. But from a 30,000 foot perspective, my job was just to get the best Robin into the movie. And I think for the most part, we did. I think it's a really – it's got a lot of heart. You know, no surprise to Columbus. He's amazing. And Robin gave his all. And Robin in the dress, you know, I'm buying that pitch. You know, I'm buying that pitch.
It's not a hard sell. Like, Robin as an older British woman.
That scene in the restaurant, man. I mean, it read funny on the
page. Oh, my God. That is a beautifully edited scene.
It's not funny, but like when it came all together and we had the music in, and I got to give Pierce Brosnan a ton of credit, just being the straight man is Robin's just going off. And like every euphemism for screwing that he threw at him.
No,
I've never heard before. I'm like, oh, my God. And Pierce is just like trying to keep it together, as soon as Chris and Yalcata is like, oh my God, you know. So yeah, it's
essentially editing improv almost. It's like editing like an improv session, because like you're saying, one part's present tense here, there's like the best ones here, but you can't edit it. And I've had that experience as well, not at that extreme, of course, but it's not easy for people listening. Editing that kind of, like, if it's not on the script specifically and you're just kind of going off, it's not easy to cut that together. And I can only imagine Robin Williams.
I mean, it could have gone with that one, but it wasn't as good. Like, I was just determined to get the best of the best in there. And we didn't take a lot out of that movie. I think it pretty, you know, honestly, the movies you mentioned, Home Alone and Pretty Woman and Mrs. Doubtfire, they all pretty much worked from the beginning. Like, the minor changes, a little bit of this, but no, like, oh my God, we got to fix the whole second act or anything, which happens in a lot of movies. We got to reshoot an ending, which happens in a lot of movies. So I guess the message is when they work, and those movies work great.
So now you're one of the top editors in Hollywood at this point. Your career is on fire. You're working on some of the biggest blockbusters, you know, whether you knew they were blockbusters at the time or not, you're still, you know, the luck is amazing, from Home Alone to Pretty Woman. You know, those two were out of the box. No one really knew what it was going to be. And there's many other films like that in your
film. By the way, I take no offense to the luck, because it was lucky as hell. I mean, just a lucky guy, you know.
So. I mean, as an
other editors, and they're like, you really stepped in shit, didn't you?
A lot of times. I mean, looking at your editing filmography, you're just like, Jesus, man. Like, how did he just keep getting a hit after hit after hit? It was, and you know, like, obviously Miss Doubtfire was kind of like in the bag. Like, we knew it was going to be a hit just because of what it was, but you kept doing that. So now you're the hottest editor in town. One of the hottest editors in town. Your career is on fire. And you're like, you know what? I think I'm gonna retire. I think it's just too much. I have had too much success. Exactly. I need to do what?
Too much fun. Like,
this I'm is, having too know, much fun. No one should be having this much fun. And I'm getting paid for what I love to do. And I'm working with the greatest artist in the field. I need to stop this. So you decide at that point to go, you know what? I'm gonna do what everybody says they want to do. I'm going to direct. So the question is, why did you want to direct? Is that something that was always in the back of your head? Because it was for me. Like, I jumped into editing, but I always wanted to be a director. Editing was just a means to an end for me. Was that like it for you? Or did you just decide, you know what, I want to try this?
It was never like a burning desire, you know. But as an editor, as you know, you see all the takes come in and you see the coverage, you're like, Where's the close-up going to be? There's the close-up. Okay. So, I mean, you know how to cover a scene just from being an editor, right? You know, so I figured I could probably manage that part. I guess pulling back a little bit, look, comedy editors never win Oscars. And so I was definitely aware of that. Right. And so every year the editing Oscar would go to some action movie or something, which was amazingly well edited, but I knew where I was. I wasn't, you know, so the question for me was, do I try and transition somehow into that world? Or do I try and direct, you know? And that was just sort of like in the back of my head, like you were saying, nothing was uncomfortable. Life was pretty good. And then an interesting thing happened, and this is no one to blame, but Mrs. Doubtfire won a Golden Globe, and Chris's mom was sick, so he wasn't there. So the line producer, Mark Radcliffe, who I love, went up to accept the award, and he had his little list, and he like basically thanked everyone down to the caterer except me.
Oh.
And so I'm watching that, and like it's one of those moments. It's like at that moment I figured, okay, like I'm not mad. I know Mark. I love Mark. I know it wasn't intentional or anything. But it also told me I'm just a comedy editor. You know, that's so if I ever want to, you know, I don't know. It's just like at that point the gong banged a little bit louder. It's like, okay, I'm going to try this. So, my wife and I were writing during all this time, and so sent out the script. Yeah. But I actually talked to an agent about maybe representing me as a director, and he was like, yeah. And then I called the editing, the below the line editing agent at that agency, and said, hey, you know, I may come over to your agency, you know, if they represent me in other areas. And the phone rang like 5 minutes later and said, yeah. So basically my editing saleability got me in the door at UTA. But then another lucky thing happened. This is a story of one lucky guy. Hughes decided to make Home Alone 3. Chris was not going to do it. And so it's sort of, who are we going to get? And, you know, I told my agent, I saw this like a little blurb in the trades. And I called my agent and said, what about me? And he said, I don't know. I'll call. So John was like, yeah, I'll talk to Raj. And I flew to Chicago and had the meeting. And you know, within 3 hours, I was on the plane back to L.A. and heard that I was directing Home Alone 3. So I was like, okay, shit, now I got to learn to do this.
And John Hughes is being your producer on this?
Yes.
So how – What's that like? What's it like having the 800-pound gorilla as your boss? On that level, because it's one thing to be the 800-pound gorilla as the boss of the editor, but there's a lot of people between you and him. There's nothing between you two at this point.
I should put it this way: he was 800-pound gorilla to the studios. Like he was like the nuclear umbrella. So this magical umbrella fell over your production. And no bullets from the outside were able to penetrate it. So that was John's version of exercising his 800-pound gorilla. In fact, he shot in Chicago. He never worked in LA. He shot in Chicago and posted in Chicago just to keep those guys away. You know what I mean? The only person allowed in was Jake Bloom, his lawyer. And so it's actually great. You know, once John writes a script, like that's what you're shooting. You know, there's no changes. So if I wanted to do something a little different, I'd shoot his version. I'd shoot my version. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it actually went pretty well on schedule, on budget, and blah 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 blah. And the movie didn't do great. I can't sit back and say Home Alone 3 was as good as the first one. You know, because it's just not. But it got me in the director's chair and got me going and got me to Never Been Kissed, which is
with Drew Barrymore. Yeah, I remember that movie. That was a really cute, you know, kind of romantic comedy.
That's the next one that comes back. Like it's, you know, you think you had this whole career and the people are like, I love Never Been Kissed, you know?
Yeah, right. Exactly. That's nice with the whole Pretty Woman and Home Alone, but Never Been Kissed.
I know. It's a beloved movie.
It is. It's so cute.
I had a 25-year anniversary recently, and you know, I did a couple of interviews or whatever. But it's just one of those movies that is of the time, and I have to give 100% of the credit to Drew because she's just so vulnerable in the movie, and the Josie Grossi, and you know, the writing's great, and she and Nancy Givonen produced it, and we've got a great cast together. So all great elements. But I mean, at the end of the day, when she's out there on that pitching mound and the clock is ticking down and she's in her little dress and her little tear forms, it's like, you know, come on.
It's Drew at the height of her powers.
Drew must be happy. You know, the audience was just dying for this movie to end. And it did. And just so great cast, great comedy all around, and super fun to do. Super fun to do.
Now, what was the most difficult part of doing that transfer, jumping from editing to directing? Because there's a lot of post guys probably listening who dream of walking down your path or even just trying to get into the directing side. What was the most difficult part of that for you?
You gotta learn to talk. It sounds so simple, but like when you're an editor, if you have an idea, there it is. I've got the sound, the music, the dialogue, like here's my idea. And then when you're a director, there's obviously nothing to cut. There's only words on a page. And so, you know, you meet with studio people and you meet with department heads, and it's like, you have to learn to verbalize what's in your head, a visual concept that's in your head. And that was a learning curve for me. I feel like I did pretty well at it. Look, I've never been the smartest guy in a room. And I've accepted that. And I don't need to be the smartest guy in the room, but, I'm a pretty damn good listener. I think that's maybe my superpower. So when studio head A and studio head B say completely the opposite things but think they're agreeing, then I think I know what to do with that and figure out what the real note is and manage that and work all that. So that's the difference. In an editing room, it's you and the director and then maybe the producer near the end. The politics are very small. Whereas in a movie, in pre-production, the politics are very big. And then on set, you know, the politics are big too. So being able to describe your vision, whether it's to, you know, the head of the studio who you want to hire you, to this great actor or actress who you hope will agree to be in your movie, down to the set design, to the director of photography, like focusing in on what their thing is and trying to put into words you know, what you see. And then also sort of letting go, like, which tie would you like, sir? Well, either one, that's your department. You know, like there's certain things, you know, certain things I really, really trust you guys to do the best possible thing here because you're wonderful at it.
Now, and then so Never Been Kissed and Home Alone obviously weren't huge monster hits at the time. Even though they, you know, Never Been Kissed has definitely gained its popularity over the years. But your first big hit was Big Mama's House. And yeah. Big Mama's House with Martin Lawrence, that kind of was that he had already done Bad Boys at that point. So he was already on his way up. But Big Mama's House really cemented him, right?
He just done Blue Streak, which did really well, really funny. Blue Streak, yeah.
Yeah, Blue Streak. Yeah, yeah, I remember. Yeah, when he was the cop and chasing the.
He just done that. And that movie came out as we were sort of talking about this. He was definitely a bankable star. And Fox, I was working at Fox. I had never been kissed for Fox and also Home Alone. And so this was a Fox movie and they're like, what about Raj? And so I met with Martin and met with the producer, David Friendly, and it seemed like a good match and got to do that. So that was great. The biggest trick on that is that, you know, Martin could only survive in all that, not survive, but, you know, be functional for a few hours a day. So just the logistics of, you know,
and the pressure.
From a production standpoint, it'd be like, here's a master, here's Martin's close up, new set. Here's a master, here's Martin's close up, new set. You know, then after Martin was done, we sort of come back to the original thing and, you know, shoot coverage. So it was hard, it was just a different way of planning a shooting day and so making sure I didn't miss something. And so I was a little on edge the whole time. Like, I hope I don't need Martin for this next couple shots or whatever. So, but all in all, it was great. Martin was great. I mean, he gave it all into that Big Mama role. Nia Long, fantastic. Terrence Howard was a sort of a great bad guy. We had fun, the fun music and him doing that big church scene, which sort of brought down the house when he was up there singing and dancing. And that was just like an idea, like, oh yeah, Big Mama should testify. And then, you know, so Don Reimer, the late Don Reimer, wrote that and just wrote an amazing something about in the back of an El Camino, you know, it was just perfect. And then Martin delivered it and then music started, he started dancing and we're all rolling cameras and it was just like, you know, felt like that. So it was really a fun movie to do. And like we originally had a release date, we're shooting in the spring. We originally had a release date like in October or something. And then Tom Sherrick, who was the head of distribution at the time for Fox, came to me and said, look, there's this, Nutty Professor 2 is coming out in July. We'd like to get out ahead of them. What do you think? I said, yeah, if it's better for the movie, we'll do it. And so basically, long story short, we wrapped the movie, we were on the mixing stage in 2 weeks and had an answer print like 4 weeks later. Like we were shortest feature post ever. And fortunately it worked, you know?
Yeah. It was a huge worldwide hit. And then you got into the next phase of your career that I see is the CG character phase where
CG
you
critter world
the CG critter world where you obviously you took on Scooby-Doo, which was and this is 2002 if I'm not mistaken, around there, right?
I think 2000, and then the first one came out in 2001 and the second one in 2003. Yeah, 2002, 2004. Yeah.
So it's around there, and you know, to be fair, you know, CG was, you know, we've already done the T Rex, you know, but you were kind of on the cutting edge because there wasn't a lot of please correct me if I'm wrong, there wasn't a lot of animated CG characters who were just like full blown characters who were going to be interacting with live action and talking. Like, I don't remember a lot of other movies around that time that we're doing that. So it was kind of on the edge of technology. Am I wrong on that? Or was there other films in
I think it kind of was, and just in terms of the amount of screen time.
Yeah, it was a huge amount.
And the amount of interaction, like Shaggy's got to hold Scooby. How do we work that out? Yeah, Shaggy's got to, you know, they got to break through windows or whatever. So there was a lot of sort of brain work. I had a really good visual effects crew. Also had to figure out, because a lot of times the visual effects people will say, yeah, we can do that for, but it's going to cost, $20 million. And so, that's not going to happen. So how are we going to do it for not $20 million? So you have to sort of reverse engineer things a lot of times. And that's just the process. We all want it to be good. And Rhythm and Hues, I think, was our visual effects house. Yeah, they were sort of famous for Critters. And I got to give a lot of credit to Matt Lillard, because, the gang walking into a scene, and he's sort of mind this sort of thing, bumping his leg, like when you're walking with a dog, mm-hmm. Where it comes in, and he just, everything he did when Scooby wasn't there, you just had a sense that he was there. Matthew was just sort of aware of the Scooby of it all. So that helped. And James Gunn wrote a great crazy script, and we got Rowan Atkinson to be our great crazy spooky island guy, and so yeah, it was a lot of fun, and a lot of R&D on the dog. Like every time some new movie comes out, there's always some outrage about the character. It was about Scooby. It was about it was about Blue Aladdin. Someone gave me a call about the when Will Smith was going to be the Blue Aladdin. And
yeah, Sonic. It was. But to be fair, the Blue Aladdin and the Sonic were kind of terrifying at the first run that they had to fix it up. Sonic was terrifying. I'm sorry.
Sonic looks like a woodland creature.
It was so terrifying. I was like, what is that? But
anyway, so there was all this Sturm und Drang around the movie, and. Another thing that was weirder on that movie is it was sort of the dawn of the internet, and what Drudge Report was to politics, Ain't It Cool News was to the film business, and everybody read this site, and without a frame shot, like the Harry Knowles just like fucking hated me and fucking hated James Gunn and hated the script. And so
wow.
Like we'd be in pre-production working along and they'd be like, there's another post. What's it say?
Yeah.
So it was weird, like working under that kind of scenario where this outside provocateur, I guess, is like causing all this angst, not just targeting because it's targeting you, but also in the industry, like it just set a whole thing because it was so powerful at that time. So that was the only weird thing working under that kind of thing where we were under constant attack for when we hadn't even shot a film or even had a finished script. So that's where I know the Marvel people deal with it all the time. Now it's become sort of a more normal thing where everybody hates everything until it's done. And I can't imagine what the Star Wars people go through. My God. Fans are like, you better not do this.
No, it's brutal. And for people that weren't around at that time, Ain't It Cool News, because they reviewed a couple of my films and they were very pleasant, thank God. But at the time, I mean, they basically single-handedly destroyed Batman and Robin. Like that last they destroyed it before it ever came out, and it never got off the ground. Not that it's a particularly great installment of the Batman franchise, but they destroyed it, and you weren't that far off from that time period. It was like I think it was 97 when Batman Rum, so they were still at the height of their power. So I could only imagine all they heard was like Scooby-Doo live action, who the hell is this guy, screw it, and they just went after you. And he definitely was a provocateur. I agree with you 100%. Now, I mean, you and James Gunn and a couple other, they've done okay. And not many people are talking about Ain't It Cool News anymore. So,
in fact, interesting, and I haven't talked to James about this, so this is going to be complete speculation. Mm-hmm. But the tweets that James got in trouble for last year or whatever.
Yeah.
When I read them, I was just like, this is Ain't It Cool language. Like, how many times would Harry Knowles say, yeah, I jizzed on some kid's head. It was so good. Like, that was just the language of that time and the language of that site. And so he and I both, took a lot of punishment from that site. And my instinct was just like, I'm never going to turn on the internet again. I have no socials, blah, blah, blah. But he is a much smarter person than I am. And he like engaged and started a Facebook, and he completely got immersed in that world. And so it was no surprise to me to see those. And, but of course in the time that it came out, like all context was lost. And so, you know, it's a little sub note to the Ain't It Cool story.
I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, like, look, if we all start pulling things back from when we were in high school and things that we did when we were in our 20s, like, I'm so glad there was no social media when I was a teenager or in the 20s. I can only imagine. Like, it just would be insane. So I agree with you. It's like, look at the reference point. You know, it is what it is. Now, I've been dying to ask you this because you've done, you know, between the Scooby-Doos, the Smurfs, which you also did, you know, what kind of pressure is there? And we kind of touched upon it right now, but what kind of pressure is it on you to be directing such a large IP? And how do you balance the loyalty to the story you're trying to tell versus, you know, making the fans happy, making the people who followed these characters for 30, 40, 50, 60 years, whatever the length of time they've been around? How do you balance that? Because you didn't do it just with one icon. You did it with two, the Smurfs and Scooby-Doo. So how do you balance that? We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
The answer is we do our best. You know, we do our best to honor the original source material, but provide something new. Because why else would you be making a movie if you're just going to tell the same stories? Mm-hmm. And honestly, you know, it's a whole team. When there's IP at this level, there's producers, there's studios, they're writing $100 million checks. I mean, everyone, it's all eyes on this, and everyone has notes. And so, so it's really, it becomes a committee, which is, you know, can be a good thing, a bad thing. But just, there's a lot of eyes and a lot of really smart people working on both of those movies. But in terms of like my job as a director, I just sort of try and protect the story as much as I can and protect the characters within that story and be as true to make the best version of the script that I was hired to shoot. You know what I mean? And that's the only way we can go into it. I mean, you know, making a movie is there's this sort of global, like, these are the tracks we're on, and we're going to stay on these tracks, and these are the borders that we can't go outside of, and there's all that, you know, from the 30,000 feet. But on the day to day, you got two cameras, you got this, you got this, you got the techno crane, you got this, you know, just like, I want to get this shot where, you know, Neil Patrick Harris is running and the Smurf does this and everything else. So once the cameras are rolling, you totally flip from what you're talking about, which is how do you honor the IP? And it's more into just like executing the day to day of a really, really complicated mm-hmm. movie. And then when you get in post, now you're wearing the first hat again. And in a sense, you know, I've had a lot of movies that sort of got beat up in post by having sneak previews and stuff. So Scooby is sort of a pretty famous example of it. I'm sure you're aware of that story. Yeah.
Which one?
The R-rated Scooby-Doo story.
No, I don't. I don't know that story.
Oh my God. Okay. So the first Scooby, that James wrote and that the studio greenlit, by the way, mm-hmm. was to the Scooby cartoon what Austin Powers was to James Bond. Very self-referential, very naughty, I guess, very sort of a lot of winks at the audience who grew up with it, who always wondered, was Shaggy like
high? He was always high. He was always – there are images. I've seen them in the cartoon where they were in pot fields. There was pot fields in the background. It was something that everybody knew. There was smoke in the mystery machine. We knew what Scooby snacks were. Come on, guys. Yeah. I mean
Exactly. So, was Velma maybe gay? I don't know.
There was a whole bunch of that. Yeah.
Stuff. So this is all in the movie. And
in a kids movie.
Well, now there's where that, hang on, that's the distinction, see?
Right.
We didn't necessarily go out thinking we were making a kids movie. We went out thinking we were making Austin Powers-ish, you know, the Scooby of Austin Powers.
Right.
But then, you know, after we shot this movie and we're in post-production, there was some marketing survey done and, you know, the marketing came back where who's the core audience for this movie? And it turned out to be, no surprise, parents and their kids, because that's what the previous IP was. And so so they sent us to sneak the movie like in a really conservative part of the country with kids, parents and their, you know, 3 to 4 year olds. And of course we got killed. You know, we were basically sent there to get killed.
Right.
And then so we had to cut the movie down. And, you know, so basically the head of the studio at the time said, you know, until it plays great for this core audience, like, I'm not going to support anything that you guys are doing with that over there. So anyways, that's the story of the unreleased Scooby movie. We didn't set out to make an R, by the way. We're not stupid. It was going to be like PG-13, but it actually did go to the ratings board and they gave it an R because they misunderstood one word, which was we had this little voodoo character and he said the Arnuki beast, and they had something very much dirtier than that. So
then with the Schneider cut that just has been done, is there going to be a Raja cut of Scooby-Doo one day? Like, are they ever going to allow to release the R-rated version of Scooby?
I pitched it, but unfortunately, Scooby-Doo is still a big IP there, and the IP is still, you know, for that age group. So I don't think it's ever going to see the light of day. But it would have been fun. But on the other hand, I'm also really glad because you can watch it with your kids, and
sure.
a lot of people grew up with it, and they come to me now, and you know they may not have seen it if we'd gone with the first version. So you know maybe that was the right thing to do at the end of the day.
So after doing all these CG critters, man, I have to ask you how do you direct them? How do you direct actors interacting with, you know, critters? Like, you know, I've worked on visual effects shows that, you know, oh yeah, there's a monster over here, or the background's going to change there. But like, you're literally having dialogue with a Smurf or with a dog. Like, how do you direct that? And how technically do you go into that?
It's mostly hard on the actors themselves. Cause, for instance, well, with Scooby, so here's the scene. I've blocked it in my head and I have it all written down what's going to happen. And so when we go to rehearse, we've got a guy with a full-size Scooby sort of walking along besides, and Scooby's going to land here. He's going to look up at Matt. He's going to do this. He's going to do that. He's going to wander off over here. So you basically block it with a maquette, you know, with a full-size thing. And then it was up to Matt and the and we maybe put like a green mark on the floor where the look to Scooby would be, those sorts of tricks. But in terms of like all that interaction, it's Matt sort of just being a great mime and just making like feeling the weight of Scooby and all that hard stuff is it all falls to the actor at that point. Same with Neil Patrick Harris. There was one of the favorite scenes in Smurfs was. They're all in his office and they're messing with his things and there's Smurfs everywhere and there's this one's got dialogue and that one's got dialogue and that one's got dialogue and we have voice characters on set. They're just basically firing these lines at him, and we have little puppeteers who, like, if a Smurf's going to touch a light, we have a little puppeteer like tug the light at a certain time. And so that's all the fun behind the scenes stuff, because you got to move stuff in the real world to interact with the characters. So we're always like moving things around them. So my directing is, okay, Neil, there's going to be a Smurf here. He's going to go here. He's going to climb up this lamp. He's going to turn and say, har, 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 and then he's going to do something. And in the meantime, this Smurf's going to be talking, that Smurf's going to be talking. And so the scene comes out great, but you can see like halfway through where Neil like completely loses his looks and he just goes like, but it's funny because he's like overwhelmed by all these Smurfs. So, It kind of comes down to, so we rehearse it with these little Smurfs and we do the voices and where they're going to go and where they're going to be. And then put a few key, eye lines for the actors, but then it's just off and go. And then, start the animation.
And so not only do you work with CG characters, but you also do two things that everybody says never to direct, which is children and animals. and you've done a few movies with children and animals. Yes. So and then not only animals, but animals that will have some sort of CG element attached to them because they're talking animals.
Right. Talking dogs. That's my
That's like you're like, and this is so funny. This is Hollywood, man. This is so funny because you did Beverly Hills Chihuahua, right? Which was wasn't a big project. It was like a smaller project. It wasn't expected to do big business, right? If I'm not mistaken, right?
Yeah, it was. We hoped it would do well, but we didn't have like a big all-star cast.
Right. Exactly. And then, you know. You've got these dogs and you've got these CG elements involved. Like how do you do that? Like the first time I saw that was Babe, and I saw Babe and I'm like, and Babe was, Babe is one of the, that's amazing little film.
Babe picked it all up.
Babe is the one that started this whole, okay. Oh, but I was going to say like Hollywood's such a weird place because you did Beverly Hills Chihuahua is like, well, Raja's the talking dog guy.
Yeah.
Like if you're going to make a talking dog movie, it's Raja because you've done it once and it did it successfully once. So now you're the dude. It's just the way Hollywood works.
There's no Aaron Sorkin scripts in my inbox. I'm just saying. Those just don't make it to me for some reason. I don't know why. So, the process is the same, I guess, the process is different in that basically I'm directing on set. I'm directing the dogs, mass movements, and the dog's face in a sense, where the dog looks and how the dog stands. But it's basic things. If the dog's supposed to be happy and peppy, then it wags its tail and it's up like this. If it's supposed to be sad or whatever, it's kind of droopy and then getting them to sort of do eye lines with each other. that's just great, sort of
amazing.
It's great. Working with the trainer team because they're all off camera going, Max, what are we doing? Look over here. And then, sometimes like I had a character, Delgado, in Beverly Hills Chihuahua, and he was hiding a secret. So I decided that most of his lines, I actually have him not looking at Chloe when he said them. So I could just kind of let him be a dog for a minute. And the dog would sort of look over here, and then he's going to look over there, and then we sort of bring him back in, and then we let him look over here. So, but going on with dialogue, it's like, yeah, kid, yeah, back when I was a cop, we didn't talk about those kind of things. So just like having in your head, like,
wow,
if it was a person, what would the attitude be? How do I apply that to a dog in terms of that, just to get that attitude? So that's the trick. And I'm sure no one in your audience is ever going to want to direct a talking dog movie. So,
well, no, you'd be surprised. Like I had on the show, the creator of Air Bud.
He's made an entire industry of that. Like hats off to the guy.
He was a screenwriter. He created it, and I think he was involved with the first two or three. And now he just collects a check every single time they put out a new Air Bud movie. Just so you explaining it, I've never sat down because I've directed children a bunch, but directing, I think animals, like I kind of just let them go. I never thought of them as like, because you're talking dogs. It's not like just dogs. It's just like talking dogs. So you have to think about them.
They have to become characters.
You got to think about how you're going to direct them and how you're going to move and how the eye line's going to work. And do you make your days? I mean, always make your days with animal. Like that must.
I've never gone over schedule on any movie I've ever done.
That's amazing.
I mean, I got every shot I wanted, but I've got every.
Yes, famous words of every director. I made the day, but I didn't get. We never look. Is there ever been a day that you walked on set and gotten every single shot on your shot list?
Yeah, but then something must have been wrong.
It's an alternate universe at that point.
I add shots here so I can write scratch them off.
I give my shot to the first AD, and the first AD is like, "This is not. It's very ambitious, Alex. It's very ambitious." I'm like, "I know, 50% of it's gone, but it's there just in case."
I'm always like, "We could get lucky."
Yeah, right, exactly. I mean, I know it's 12 hours, and it's the same as 12 hours for everybody on the planet, but for us, it's really gonna time will stop, and we're gonna get an extra 5 hours.
It's the same lighting setup, you know.
Yeah, exactly. We don't even have to move the camera.
The DP's like, no, it's not.
We'll just shoot a wide in 8K and just punch in. It'll be fine. We'll shoot just one wide and we'll punch in. It'll be great. And DPs love that. Now, tell me about your new film, Gun and a Hotel, which has no talking dogs, has no CG critters, or a giant dog or Smurfs. So tell me, it's a little bit outside of your wheelhouse. So I'm curious
all
about this.
All those tricks have been taken away.
Exactly.
Yeah, so it's a drama. I guess it's a drama that involves faith. And the log line is that a young man walks into a hotel room contemplating an act of violence, and he encounters a personified hotel Bible. And the Bible basically spends the next hour trying to talk him out of doing this act of violence. And it started as an award-winning play. And we went to see the play, and it was just, you know, great writing, great acting. But what really struck me was on the sidewalk afterwards, like people just in knots and they're talking about this movie. They're having these passionate conversations about this movie. And it just really touches people. And it touches people, like if you come from a church background, like there's a voice for you. If you come from a completely, you've never been to church in your entire life, there's a voice for you. It's just extremely well-balanced and extremely well executed discussion about morality and scripture and just all things heavy like that. But it's also it's got a lot of humor in it too. These characters they debate, but they also bond, and it's just an incredibly sort of emotional journey that these characters go on together for their 1 hour together. Until the clock ticks down.
That's amazing. Is it out already, or has it been released yet?
January 5th. It's on all the streaming sites, iTunes, Amazon, all the normal places. So,
and I will put a link to that in the show notes. I advise everyone to take a look at it because it sounds extremely interesting. It sounds like
it feels like a play on film, in a way, but I think in a good way. I think part of the dramatic appeal of it basically takes place in one room, but this character can't get out. Like he can't leave, and he keeps being confronted by this personified Bible. So I think the claustrophobic nature of it actually lends to the dramatic nature of it as well. And I'm feeling really excited about it, and hoping some people see it. We've gotten really good response from on the secular side, but also on the faith side. So I don't know if a movie's ever like sort of crossed over like that.
Right.
But there's literally a voice for all characters, and no straw man arguments. So if you feel like sort of, you know, snuggling up on a cold winter's night and getting into some deep philosophical and scriptural discussions, then this is your movie.
Absolutely. And God knows we're not doing a whole heck of a lot nowadays. We're pretty much staying at home and watching stuff. So I think that might be a good movie to watch. Now, what are you working on next? And what's the next stuff you're coming up with?
Developing. I haven't had anything that's been sort of COVID shut down because I've been developing stuff. And it's more on the lines of what you'd think. It's talking critters, and it's just sort of more in the family film zone that you would expect me to be working in. And so we'll see. Nothing I can talk about specifically right now, but hopefully a couple big pieces of IP that we'd like to get going. And once COVID lifts, we hope to be making movies.
That would be, we're all hoping that COVID lifts and we can start making movies. I mean, and as of this recording, we live in LA, which is ground zero at this point in the game. It's really rough out here. It's really scary. And God, I'm just hoping that 2021 just starts. We see some sort of light at the end of this tunnel for a lot
I'm
of people.
Optimistic, man. I think theaters are going to come back full. And I think people are dying to get out.
God, I would love to go see a theater again.
Just go on a date. It's like the simplest date, just to go to the movies. So So hopefully the vaccine will kick in soon enough. And, you know, all the gloom and doom we've been hearing about the industry will sort of, you know, evaporate a bit. Look, streaming's always going to be streaming. It's going to keep getting more and more. But I have a strong feeling that the theaters are going to survive and we'll be back to those big screen experiences.
Absolutely. My wife the other day just said, like, we saw a commercial for a restaurant. We're like, oh, a restaurant. Oh, like, she's like, I just want to go eat somewhere. I just want to go. Remember the days where we could just go eat? Like, we're not asking a lot. Like, just to go sit down enclosed in a room with other people close by and just eat a good meal, have some conversation. Nice. It's a weird and wacky. We are living in an alternative universe, I feel, without question.
Now
I'm going to ask you the last few questions I ask all my guests. What advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
Just make films, do what you're doing, like make stuff, reach out to the agents, you know, whatever the next person up on the rung that you know or you have connections to, agents. Like this movie, you know, this movie we got on Hotel Bible, I'm talking about. We did like the film festival circuit, made enough noise to get a distributor and all that stuff. So this is a movie that was shot in 4 days of interiors and 1 day of exterior. And we managed to get distribution. So it can happen, and it happens by making doing your craft and doing good stuff, you know. And you don't you don't have to necessarily, like, you could start as an editor like you and I did, you know. You don't have to necessarily start as, I want to be the executive producer and I want to direct the thing that I've written, you know. Start as an assistant. Start somewhere that you can work laterally into what you want to do more. But there's learning steps along the way, and man, there's just so much content being made now. And like you said, Alex, like, people can make movies in their garages, you know what I mean? So, so, you know, obviously getting those movies viewed is harder in this age when there's a billion things on TikTok and on YouTube to compete with. So that's the tricky part, but you're learning skills along the way. Even if someone doesn't see your short film, You've produced a movie and you've shot a movie and you've edited a movie. So, just keep doing it and keep reaching out. And if something comes up where you can get a foot in the door, even, like, I never pictured myself as an editor, you know, that's kind of just happened. So if you can get your foot in the door somewhere and, you know, if you don't love that, then try and move laterally to the direction you want to move. If you're on a film set as a boom guy, but you really want to be a camera operator, go hang out with the camera guys, you know, you learn a thing or two. So, I guess that's the way to do it. I wish I had a magic wand, but I don't.
And would you be fair to say that your success as a director is wholly in part from all of the years you worked in post? Because I think that you, and please correct me if I'm wrong, and this is just my looking in, you got a job like a Scooby or, you know, obviously Smurfs, but Scooby specifically, because, like, okay, we need a director who knows comedy, but also understands post and understands that whole work. Cause there's directors, I'm sure you know, who don't even understand anything about post-production. Cause I've had them in my edit suite. So you learning all these tools prepped you and got you able to give you these opportunities that you might have not been able to do, as opposed to you trying to just, you know, jump into, like you said, the executive producer. Like, you want to get to the top right away. I'm like, no, if you chop wood, carry water. Chop wood, carry water. Is that a fair statement?
I think that's definitely a fair statement. And I think that I probably was hired Scooby, you know, based on around, he must know something about post.
It's perception.
Yeah, exactly. Perception. Exactly. I think that's less prevalent now. Just because like Marvel is just a machine, you know?
Oh, yes, and
so, like, a director will come on. It's like, here's the entire storyboard department. You want a big fight? Let him go. And, you know, I'm not in Marvel, so I'm projecting a little bit, but I think that it's maybe a little easier now for non-technical people to sit in that chair because there's enough technical support around.
But at the highest level, though. Not at the indie level. At the indie level, you got to know some stuff.
You're yourself, man. You're not there for marker. So I think, like you're saying, I think you chop the wood, carry the water, learn the craft, really. If you can get your foot in somewhere, then grab it, man, and go and try and move laterally onto the next thing.
Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
Ooh, that is a very good question. Wow, Alex, you hit me with one. I want to say, I don't think I've learned the hardest lessons yet. Let's bring it back to the film business here. So, sure. I guess when to talk and when to shut up.
Amen. Preach, brother. Preach.
You walk into a room as the director and like everyone looks at you and you know you have to talk, you know what I mean? But sometimes like you want to, sometimes there's other times when you should just actually listen better. And so I still don't, I've never been particularly, I've never been comfortable socially. And I don't think I have social anxieties, but I'm not great in a group. Like one-on-one, I'm pretty good. Like a group of 10, like not so good, you know, around a board table with a bunch of executives, terrible.
But again, you've done okay. You've done okay.
I limped through, I guess the lesson I learned is sometimes those things that you really, really don't want to do, you got to suck them up and do them to get to where you want to go. So as much as I dread going into that boardroom with a bunch of execs and doing a dog and pony show, I got to do it. And as much as I dread going to those sneak previews where I know the cards are going to come in and people are going to start wanting to rip apart my movie, you got to do it. And you got to do your job in all that and do as best you can, do as honestly as you can, and do it from the heart.
And last question, 3 of your favorite films of all time.
Oh, my gosh. This one. Well, I'm going to say It's a Wonderful Life because we watch it every year. I'm going to say Guardians of the Galaxy, the James Gunn.
So
first
good.
Guardians was great. I love that. And honestly, like first Men in Black, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like that was just those, both of those movies. I go to Wonderful Life just cause it makes me cry every year. I may go Forrest Gump even. I'm all over the place. Well,
all good choices. All good choices.
I could rewatch that first Pirates any day of the week. Love that. I mean, what Gore did in that movie and what James did in Guardians and what Barry Sonnenfeld did in Men in Black, like I wish I could do that. It's just this nails on. The tone was perfect. The movie was a fun ride. And I'm giving you a category of my favorite movies.
It's completely fine. It's a completely acceptable answer, sir. And those films have hit the list here on the Indie Film Hustle podcast a couple times. So, no question. Good choices. Raja, man, thank you so much for being on the show. It was an absolute pleasure talking to you and going down your history and your filmography and an amazing career that you've had, and very lucky as you have declared, you've stepped into it, sir. You've stepped into it a couple times. But it's been an absolute pleasure, and I wish you nothing but the best in the future, my friend. Thank you so much.
I'd love to get together and talk war stories offline and get the real dirty deeds.
A pleasure, my friend. Talk to you soon.
Likewise.
I want to thank Raja so, so much for coming on the show and dropping his knowledge bombs with the tribe today. Thank you so much, Raja. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/432. And as promised, guys, I've got a hell of a lineup of guests coming up in the coming weeks. So definitely keep an eye out for that. Thank you so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at IndieFilmHustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.